Welcome to Prime Video's Culture-Rated Collection. This is the place where Black is the main character, where we don't jump through hoops just to hear our voice and can fall in love with illuminating documentaries like Giannis, The Marvelous Journey.
I'm just a hard worker that's trying to survive.
Enjoy the animated series, The Second Best Hospital in the Galaxy.
All doctors report immediately!
Where we dive into something new like the latest season of Them, The Scare, and the award-winning American Fiction.
Welcome home, baby!
Or add to the experience by buying or renting the biopic of a legend, Bob Marley, One Love.
I want my music to unify people.
And add on channels like Paramount Plus and Stars to bask in nostalgia with Beverly Hills Cop.
This is the cleanest police car I've ever been in my life.
And BMF.
You're about to take over the whole nation.
Explore Prime Video's Culture-Rated Collection and enjoy old school greats and new school hits. Prime Video. Find your happy place. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/AmazonPrime for details.
Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
It's still 18 to 20-year-old men killing each other at close range, putting steel into each other's bodies. And that's the way it's been for 3,000 years, and that's the way it's going to be.
Let's go.
Welcome to Citizen. We got a special guest today, former Navy SEAL and aspiring politician, I guess, Tim Chi. How's it going?
Good. How you doing?
I'm living the dream, you know, every day better than the last. America's in great shape. There's nothing to worry about. Correct?
Well, you're live and you got all your limbs, so, you know.
Yeah, that's true. It's a good start. So before we get into what you're up to now, because you're running for Senate in Montana, let's go back to the old day. Are you from Montana originally?
No, I grew up in Minnesota originally.
Whereabouts?
Yeah, so Anoka area. And then went into the military right at 18. And met my wife in the military. I became a SEAL officer. She was a Marine Corps officer, so we both served during the war. Between the two of us did several deployments. We saw each other about 45 days across 6 years, which, you know, is the secret to a happy marriage, is never actually see each other, right? But that was a busy time. You know, both wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, were raging in those years. And, you know, loved being a SEAL, loved leading my guys, best job in the world. But I got injured and wounded a couple of times, so eventually got medically discharged and moved on and started a business here in Montana. And the vision of the business was taking some of that technology we use on the battlefield overseas, particularly aerial infrared imaging. So aircraft on top of our ground team would provide real-time information to us as operations were unfolding. Mm-hmm. And it was a life-saving capability, whether it was electro-optic or infrared. We could see things that we could not normally see, and it was a life-saving piece of technology. And close air support, obviously, is a very important aspect of modern warfare. So we came to understand that very well as a ground team. And as ground team leader, is my responsibility. And after I got wounded, I decided to start a company to try to perfect that capability to help other people, in this case, wildland firefighters. Mm. So now we bring that same capability to our brave men and women who fight wildfires.
What's the do you work on the imaging side, or you work on the algorithmic and analysis side of that, or both?
Yeah, well, good question. Actually, all of the above and a lot of other things, too. You know, we started just two of us in the barn, a couple of veterans with all of our and created about 450 jobs here the last 9 years from scratch. It's been an amazing experience. I'm the founder, CEO of the company, and got an amazing team of at one point all veterans. As we've grown, we have been able to stay all veteran, but it's been a great project to build. And exactly. So we started out purely aerial imaging, infrared imaging, electro-optic, and then we had video processing capability in real time using machine learning, edge detection algorithms, to optimize that video, process it so that the end result coming out was more digestible and effective for the end user. And as we grew the company, we pivoted into other capabilities. And now we do everything in wildfire, from imaging the fire, doing aerial coordination for all the aircraft on the fire, app interface for firefighters on the ground who need better information. And of course, we have the water bombers, like the one you see behind me in the schematic here, that actually bomb the fire and put it out from the air.
Sure. Have you seen this new sixth-gen fighter and the AI that it's using? Because it's pretty fucking gnarly, man. I mean, it's like it is instantaneous geospatial intelligence for the first time, I think, in human history, probably.
Yeah, some impressive stuff going on. An Academy classmate and SEAL teammate of mine, Brendan Sang, is one of the founding partners at a company called Shield AI. Mm-hmm. And they're one of the leaders in innovating in that space. So, yeah, it's going to be, I don't normally subscribe to the transformation of warfare. You know, every time, especially with Ukraine going on the last couple of years, every time, you know, a drone's used in something, we're lectured about how war has forever changed. And it hasn't, and I don't think it ever will. You know, at the end of the day, you look at the pictures of Ukraine and what's happening there in Israel and Hamas. Mm. It's still 18 to 20 year old men killing each other at close range, putting steel into each other's bodies. And that's the way it's been for 3,000 years. And that's the way it's going to be. But I do believe that new tools do, of course, you know, help evolve the battlefield in different ways, some for good, some for bad. And I think we're seeing one of those now with the AI weapon revolution. Absolutely.
Yeah, for real. I mean, you know, with all the talk about drones, especially in the Ukraine theater, it's been pretty marginal, the use of them, to be honest, compared to, I mean, before the Wagner Group peeled off, they were just running full on fixed bayonet attacks and shit like that. So, I mean, it can only change so much. Let's go back to Minnesota. So, what was it like where you grew up, and what made you decide to join the military? I guess I assume as an officer, you went to university first.
No, so I you know, my neighbor growing up was a Korean War Navy pilot, and you know, I always wanted to be in the military since the first thing I can remember as a kid. My parents always tell me, I mean, we grew up in a rural area. Mm. Farmstead. So, like, you know, I'd be running around the woods, you know, wearing camouflage with a stick gun from the time I could walk, they said. So, you know, that's always kind of what I was going to do, I think. And I never knew any different. And, my neighbor, Harry, and his son, Steve Tebow, who's also a pilot, they took me up flying once, in their little Cub, you know, when I was 8, and I fell in love right away. I said, hey, this is like, aviation is amazing. I want to be a part of this. So then future kind of crystallized. I want to be a pilot. I want to be a Navy pilot, like Maverick, like everyone else did in the 80s and 90s. We all wanted to be Maverick. Sure. And so they taught me how to fly, got my pilot's license, you know, at 16, and sold at 16, license at 17, you know, grew up flying with them, and they were generous enough to let me be involved in that. And then went to the Naval Academy, wanted to be a pilot. And that was 2004, summer of 04 is when I started the Naval Academy. And when I got there, you know, very quickly realized that, you know, we were fighting two ground wars. They didn't need pilots. They didn't need any more guys flying jets. They needed leaders on the ground. Mm-hmm. And I actually resigned and tried to leave the academy that winter so I could enlist and go fight, because I was frustrated that the war was going on. And as a typical 18, 19-year-old kid full of piss and vinegar, you know, I was convinced the war would be over before I'd have my chance to do my part. And, you know, luckily an old grizzled special forces colonel talked some sense in me, said, son, like, you know, I've already done 3 deployments. We're going to be fighting this war for the next generation. Mm-hmm. There's going to be plenty of action for you. And if you really want to serve your country, you know, leaving the academy and going to fight door to door as a private or a corporal or a sergeant is not where we need you. He's like, I need young leaders on the battlefield. I need smart lieutenants and captains who can think on their own and lead people, because this is a captain's war. It's not a colonel or general's war. It's a sergeant's war, and we need sharp young leaders of high moral character to take the battlefield. So stay here, finish your education. And I did. So I actually did an exchange tour with the Army Rangers, went through Airborne Ranger School, and then became a SEAL team leader. And then, as I said, you know, fought Iraq, Afghanistan, multiple tours, South America, counter-drug operations, some missions in the Asian theater as well. Yeah. And then, like I said, met my wife at the academy. She was a Marine Corps officer and served together.
What was your impression of the GWAT? Like, I mean, I wonder from different people's perspective, because I was in the 82nd Airborne. I first deployed with the surge in 2007. And pretty much immediately when I put my boots on the ground in that country, I was like, this is fucking stupid. Like, this is a complete waste of time. We have no real goal here, right? I mean, did we? Yep. I mean, I wonder how other people thought about it, because it was very clear from the first moment I was there that, like, these people were never going to accept the brand of society that we wanted for them, which, why would they? It's not our fucking place to be telling people how to live their lives, really, but... it was very clear that they specifically had no interest in that shit. They were just kind of going along to get along.
Listen, I agree completely. I mean, it was the definition of scope creep for 20 years. You know, obviously our brave men and women in uniform were willing to do whatever their country asked of them. But the reality is our country didn't know what to ask of them. And, you know, I'm a big believer in the Powell Doctrine to go to war. You know, the Powell Doctrine has three conditions before America should ever go to war. And that is, number one, you know, does America have the popular will to conduct this conflict? Are Americans behind it? Are they ready to fight? Second, what is victory? Have we defined it? And can we win? Can victory be achieved? And if those two are yes, finally, number three is good. Then apply overwhelming force and win fast. And if you look at the three wars that were conducted under that doctrine, you know, Grenada, Panama, Gulf One, you know, for the most part, they checked all three of those boxes and the outcome was clear. You know, we went to war in Afghanistan to eliminate the safe haven for Al-Qaeda, destroy the Taliban so they would no longer harbor terror groups, so we would not get attacked again. And we did that. It took us like, you know, 90 days, you know, and then we quickly started moving the goalposts for 20 years to try to figure out, okay, what does success look like? We never defined success clear enough early on. And then, you know, if you don't know what success is in anything, whether it's business, whether, you know, it's a war, if you don't know what your success is, and listen, things do change on the ground, of course, you're a combat veteran, you know that, but we moved the goalposts so many times, and it went from eliminating terrorist safe haven to now create, you know, regional centers of stability. And then it went, well, let's make mini Americas. Let's make sure these are constitutional republics. It's like, how do you take a culture that has never even considered that, that hasn't changed since the third century BC, and all of a sudden you expect them to adopt an advanced constitutional republic in 15 years? That was never going to work. That was never going to be successful. And, you know, the military, for all of its goodness and badness, there's plenty of, as you know, fucked up things about the military. There's plenty of great things about it. You know, we're good at tactical objectives, but we're not nation builders. We never have been. Yeah. That's not on the charter, and that's what it became. And to your point, you know, it turned into something that we were never going to win. And then obviously we decided, well, not we, you know, Biden decided to yank us out of there, just like he decided to yank us out of Iraq abruptly with no plan. And then we ended up with something far worse. Now ISIS-K, based in Afghanistan, looks like they just conducted that attack in Moscow. And of course, ISIS metastasized in Iraq after we yanked out of there with no follow-on plan either. So, you know, the cure was worse than the disease. And we did not conduct those operations with clarity.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we paid trillions of dollars and too many American lives.
It's weird how we conducted that one, especially considering, and well, I'm talking about Afghanistan specifically, especially considering how we've conducted ourselves with India and Pakistan specifically, right? So the United States government funds the ISI, the internal security device of Pakistan. We have not entirely since its inception, but for a long ass time now. And we don't really see eye to eye with them on a lot of stuff. I mean, you can, if you need any evidence of that, consider that Bin Laden was living about a mile and a half down the road from their West Point, right? So obviously there's issues there. But still, the ISI specifically is not our enemy. They help our enemy sometimes, sure. And there's two factions. Some of them are friendly to us. Some of them aren't. Same kind of deal with India. It's kind of split in the same way, mostly based on their hatred of Pakistan, to be honest. But then when we went into Afghanistan, it was like, oh, we got to get the Taliban. It's like, why? I mean, yeah, we don't agree with them. They're not our cultural match for sure. We don't have, there's not a whole lot of ethical overlap between our two cultures. That's certainly true. But the Taliban wasn't our fucking enemy. We went into Afghanistan to fight the government, which would be effectively like someone invading the United States to fight the Crips or the Bloods. You know what I mean? Like, that doesn't make any fucking sense. Even if they had infiltrated parts of government, coming in and trying to fight the government of a country because they have, there's a bad element in it, is a pretty wild ass way to conduct your foreign policy, to be honest, right? I mean, I think the appropriate response would have been to give the Taliban money and be like, hey, let's fucking kill these dudes together, right? Instead of fucking the whole country up. Now, that doesn't map onto Iraq very well. We should just never have been there in the first place. But it seems like not enough people are critical of the entirety of the Afghan war, because not much of it made any sense. Like, what was the, you said it before with the Powell Doctrine, but what exactly was the desired end state? I mean, you were an officer in the SEAL teams. Did WARCOM ever, like, is there a white paper somewhere? It's like, once X is done, then fucking we're out of here. Was that ever even a discussion?
No. Oh, not that I know of, but I think that's exactly the point is, you know, success was not clearly defined. And when you don't define success, how in the world are you going to drive to that, plan to that, and then how are you going to know if you ever achieve it? You know, the success was defined, you know, in World War II. Obviously, everyone goes to World War II. That's the seminal conflict of the 20th century. But success was defined as unconditional surrender of the Axis powers. But you're absolutely right on the Taliban. And to your point, we actually did fund the Taliban. You know, they were just called the Mujahideen at that time.
Yeah.
You know, we funded them and paid for them to beat the Soviets. And I think when you look at the totality of our Middle Eastern foreign policy for the last 20 years, or I should say the last 40 years, you know, it really starts to construct this very concerning, you know, prism where you're like, we have become incompetent as a nation at projecting power and managing our influence around the world. I mean, look at the three countries we've been talking about here. You know, primarily Afghanistan, Iran, and Iraq.
Mm.
You know, most people don't realize we spent 20 years filling Iran with the latest, best technology, best weaponry. They were our closest friends in the region in the 1960s and 70s. The Shah of Iran was our buddy. And we gave the F-14 Tomcat to two people, Maverick and the Shah. And we said, you know, we need you to protect this region from Soviet influence because you're our buddy and you're going to do it. So we gave him everything, air defense systems, ground forces, best fighter planes. And then guess what? You know, he got toppled. The Ayatollah takes over. And overnight, they were and now are our longest running, most pernicious adversary in the world, funding state-sponsored terror everywhere in the world, killing Americans by the bushel, you know, brutally and systematically. And then we said, you know what? Their neighbor, this really nice guy, you know, now that they're bad, we're going to build him an army to make sure that they stay contained. And that nice guy's name was Saddam Hussein. So, you know, we paid billions of dollars to build him an army to make sure that, you know, the Iranian military that was now our enemy was contained. And of course, then they ended up going to war with each other, you know, in one of the deadliest conflicts of the century after World War II, you know, in a border conflict between the Iran-Iraq war where hundreds of thousands were killed, chemical weapons used. It was a disaster, and functionally nothing changed other than the slaughter of hundreds of thousands of people. But let's not forget, the whole time that was going on, we were filling Afghanistan with shoulder-fired missiles and AK-47s and roadside bombs so they could beat the Soviets. And then that army we built, Saddam Hussein, he decided one day, you know what, I'm gonna take that oil and Kuwait. I want it. So then we had to go and had the real American army fight one American army that we'd already paid to build. And then, you know, that war ended when we got them out of Kuwait, and we basically destroyed the army we built from the air with our Air Force. And then, you know, 10 years later, we invaded Iraq again after we invaded Afghanistan. And in both those fights, as you well know, Iraq and Afghanistan, we were fighting an Iranian-backed insurgency that was killing Americans. And of course, on the heels of all this has been the resurgence of ISIS in the region. So filling countries with other weapons hasn't usually gone well for America. You know, it looks great on the paper. We'll fight this proxy war. We don't have to go fight. We'll make these guys fight for us. But the truth is, wherever we send weapons, chances are there's going to be American troops on the ground in that country within the next decade or so. So we better be really careful when we fill these countries with military weapons and tanks and planes and missiles, because once you deliver that crate and walk away, you've lost control of it. And we don't know what's going to happen with it. And it hasn't worked out too well for us for the last half century. And America's got to start getting much, much smarter about our foreign policy, because we're entering what I believe will be the most challenging geopolitical era for America. You know, we had our early colonial years. We had our industrialization, Civil War, you know, Reconstruction years. And then we had the 20th century, the pre-war, the interwar, World War II, and the Cold War. Those were all challenging times, but in retrospect, they were relatively straightforward. we're now entering a landscape where we're going to be potentially operating amongst four co-equal superpowers, you know, America, China, India, and basically a coalition of disaffected states like Russia, Iran, North Korea, you know, potentially Saudi Arabia, who's going to work with the highest bidder. Like, they're going to do what's best for Saudi Arabia, which is what pretty much every other country in the world does. It's probably what we should do too. Let's do what's best for us. And for us to navigate this landscape, the post-Cold War landscape was so easy for us. We were the only superpower in the world, do whatever we wanted, and everyone would listen. And we kind of took on this foreign policy of like almost American self-loathing. Well, we feel bad about it, and we're going to go around the world, and we're going to spend trillions, you know, trying to hold everyone else up and recast the world in our image. We're going to force our worldview on everybody else through the prism of democracy and human rights. And the reality is, as you exactly pointed out, the rest of the world's like, hey, I already have my worldview. I don't need you to tell me what to believe. You know, you want to do business with me, you want to buy my resources, you want to trade with us, great. But don't hinge that you're going to also virtue signal to me while you do it. And I think we're seeing the consequences of 30 years of that catch up to us. And we better get smart quick, because it's a very treacherous period of time we're walking into.
This episode is brought to you by Ghostbed. Ghostbed.com/drinkingbros. Go there today and get 50% off site wide. All their mattresses, all the sheets, everything. They've got the Ghostbed Classic. They've got the Ghostbed 3D Matrix. They've got the Ghostbed Lux. And now they've got the new one, the Ghostbed Flex Hybrid. All these are cooling mattresses. They're the best in the business. They also have the new technology that we've been looking for all this time. Well, not we, just Joel, which is the RV mattress. Now, if you've got one of these things, you know that you can't find a mattress that fits them appropriately, at least not a good one. And the ones that come with them are terrible. So if you're you know, an RV person, you definitely want to jump on that. And by the way, they got the best pillows in the business. You've heard me say it before, but I travel with these things. That's how good they are. It's kind of a pain in the ass, but not as bad as sleeping on hotel pillows, I'll tell you that much. So go to ghostbed.com/drinkingbros today. Use the code Ghost or Drinker Bros at checkout. You're going to get 50% off all the mattresses. Check them out today. We've been with them for a while. I've got them all over my house. You know they're good. So my best advice here is go for the 3D Matrix. It's the most comfortable bed I've ever slept on in my life. Go get it today. Go to ghostbed.com/drinkingbros. Use the code Drinker Bros. You're going to get 50% off. That's 50% off. You're not going to get a better deal.
Yeah, I don't know that we're dumb, though. Like, it seems like we know exactly how to do it the right way, and we choose to do it the wrong way, which is probably some confluence of money and power, as it always is, right? And yeah, it's like, you would think we would learn one of these lessons at some point about arming countries, right? We built Iran's army, we built Iraq's army, we built Afghanistan's army, and we've had to fight all of them to some degree, right? Like, we haven't been in direct engagements, I guess, with Iran, but we've taken out Quds Force people like Soleimani. We've actually fought Quds Force people in eastern Iraq a little bit, if you've been in any of those operations. Especially those dicks that were funneling the RPG-29s over the border and EFPs and shit like that. I mean, that was a huge problem. But, you know, now we're doing it with Ukraine. Like, I don't worry about Israel, to be honest. Not that I don't think we should be spending too much foreign money when our country is all fucked up like this, frankly, but I don't worry about Israel using weapons against us necessarily. But, you know, Ukraine is a weird country. They're one of the most corrupt countries on earth, or they were until we became friends with them a couple of years ago, I guess. And it seems that there would be pause when they have a brigade full of people wearing swastikas and shit like that. You would think that would give someone pause before they would just hand them over the keys to the tanks and shit. But there seems to be a big part of this that is intentional, frankly. Like, I don't believe, I do believe in Hanlon's razor, which says you shouldn't imply malice where incompetence will suffice. But we have enough institutional expertise after 25 years at war that we know exactly what we're, and 60 years of quote unquote nation building, where we know exactly how this is going to turn out, and we're doing it anyways, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of that comes back to an unaccountable bureaucracy. You know, our nation is no longer ran by the people. You know, it's ran by a massive bureaucracy that has a tremendous amount of inertia in it. And, you know, when people ask me, hey, you're a military guy, then, you know, I've done a lot of, obviously, it's fighting fires. You work with the government. So you worked with the government there. Now you're running for office, which is like, why the hell would you do that? And like, don't talk me out of it. But it's time we get new people in here But the issue is we have a bureaucracy that's unaccountable to the people of this nation. It just is. And it's swelled massively in the last 60 years. And a lot of these folks, you know, I think you're right. There is intelligence and expertise. But as we saw during COVID, you know, you can have the smartest, most well people, and they can still not know. They may still not have common sense. They may be very intelligent, but intelligence and high IQ doesn't mean common sense. You can have an incredibly smart brain surgeon that can't change the oil in his pickup truck. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we've developed in our foreign policy construct. I use the comparison of NASA a lot, not to go down a rabbit hole, but, you know, Apollo 13, of course, everyone's seen the movie. Everyone saw what happened. Amazing story of American ingenuity. Disaster in space. Apollo, 13 crew, by all accounts, should have died in space. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't have come home. But they did, because Gene Kranz, the flight director, and the team on the ground in Houston was like, they will not die in space, and we're going to figure out a way to bring them home. And how they brought them home was, you had a bunch of guys working, you know, that were World War II vets, you know, that were Vietnam vets, Korea vets. A lot of them didn't have college degrees. They had practical understanding, literally with duct tape and garbage that, you know, they had on board the spacecraft, innovated ways to bring those guys home. And they did, because they had practical knowledge and experience. And then you look at the Columbia disaster of 2003. You can't armchair quarterback everything, but the reality is, you know, all the commission studies reported that NASA's response to that disaster was also a disaster. The real disaster wasn't the fact that heat tiles were chipped during the launch. It was that NASA completely failed to effectively manage solving that issue and bringing those astronauts home alive, and they all died as a result. And the big difference in those two eras was, we had a disaster. We had an accident in space in the 1960s, 1970 was. Bad technology or old technology, you know, we didn't have close to the resources we had in 2003, but we had ingenuity, we had grit, and we had common sense. And they worked the problem and brought those three men home alive. In 2003, NASA had shifted from a lot of, you know, war vets, mechanics, you know, fighter pilots, people with a lot of hands-on experience, coupled with some very, very highly educated engineers, no question. But in 03, when you look at the resumes of what NASA had kind of evolved to, it was more, quote unquote, diverse, you know, gender wise and racially. But the amount of universities, those, and Malcolm Gladwell wrote a great piece about this, actually, in one of his books, talked about how NASA had become psychologically monolithic. It was more diverse in all the DEI categories, but psychologically, they were all the same. They all went to, you know, Columbia and MIT, and they all had the same degrees from the same schools. They thought the same. And very few of them had actually worked with their hands. You know, they didn't build the spaceship. They just administered it. And when you build the spaceship, you know how to recover it during a disaster. When you just administer it, look at it on paper every day and talk about it and budget for it, that's a very different type of competency. And I think that's where we're at with our foreign policy now. I think our State Department, I think our intel agencies, I think we've atrophied where we have very few people that have been true servants on the ground for these policies. I mean, look at the U.S. Capitol right now. That building's 17% veterans in Congress right now in the Senate. We used to be over 70%. Mm-hmm. Let's face it, a lot of that 17%, no offense, thank you for them, their service and all that, but a lot of them were, you know, JAGs. They were lawyers mm-hmm. in uniform, or they were PAOs. They weren't on the battlefield seeing what the pointy end of our policy looks like. And as you well know, as you said, when you landed there and got your boots on the ground, once you're there, you see it, feel it, smell it. You know, you see your friends get blown apart, and you have to explain the strategy to a 17, 18-year-old kid to have him carry it out. You know, that crystallizes things differently. And I think we have so little practical experience in the people crafting our policy. I think it's a big reason why, you know, it's not working.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird, man. Like you mentioned a phrase where that piques my interest, NASA, their personnel now administer the shuttle and don't run it really or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. This is something that's common throughout every industry in the West right now, administrative bloat. So the average teacher salary, the average college professor salary has only gone up like 29% relative to inflation over the last 40 years or so. But the overall spending on administrative costs in college has gone up about 2,000%. And you wonder why there's a student loan crisis. No, there's not a student loan crisis. There's a retard charging too much money for nothing crisis, right? But it's not just education. Government, obviously, it always happens there. But business as well. I mean, Facebook and Twitter have fired a combined like 30,000 people, I think, over the last 3.5 years or so, right? Because they figured out, and maybe it was because their employees are making TikTok videos saying, hey, look, I get to work at 9 a.m. and then I take a 3-hour nap. And they're like, oh, shit, this person's a fucking loser. I don't need to hire this guy, right? But it seems so obvious. It used to be that things that generated certain product, work product, like finance, right? Or if there was war would be a good example as well. Those things have to be a meritocracy, otherwise they don't work correctly. But now we have all these companies, and look, you're going to see it in the stock market over the next couple of years as streaming services and apps that provide some kind of service, not a product, but a service, they're all going to start to tank because they've been propped up by angel investment money for the past 10 years, and they've actually not one of them has ever made an actual dollar. Like, they've never been profitable. None of these companies, none of the companies that deliver your food have ever made any money. Finally, BuzzFeed's going away because they've been in the red for 15 years now, right? Like, it's finally starting to catch up to everybody. But a big part of it is this, the bureaucratic bloat, the administrative bloat. And I don't understand how people keep falling for this shit, to be honest. Like, we know, and it's a worldview thing, right? Like a real conservative wants to limit the size and scope of government. That should be the whole point, right? You can argue about ethics and morals and different things like that, and the differences, like abortion, I think, is a canard. I don't think that has anything to do with this. The point of conservatism in government is to limit the size and scope of government's power, right? That's the whole point of it. And you could take that same general attitude towards your business or towards anything else. You want your creative people to be a little bit more liberal, but you want people actually running the adults to be conservative typically, right? That we've completely reversed that now. And the people that are in Congress who say they're conservative, they're not conservative. They presided over the largest expansion of the federal government in history within the last 20 years. Are you kidding me? It's like, it's very easy to become fatalistic and nihilistic about government in today's America. And now you're going to take on the challenge of trying to go there and actually do something, which is tough.
It is. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, it's been a bloating expansion of an unconstitutional branch of government. I mean, it's almost all executive branch. I mean, to put a finer point on everything you just said, I mean, 99% of what you just said is the executive branch of government. And I have this great board game we're playing with our kids now, and we homeschool our kids largely because of the Constitution. They don't teach history of the Constitution and our founding to any degree of usefulness to our youth anymore. And that's a big problem. You know, kids don't understand that we live in a constitutional republic, not a democracy. And that's a very important distinction. And, you know, we talked about the co-equal branches of government because it's a cool board game if you have young kids or whatever interested. It's called the Constitution Quest. And it's a little board game, move the piece around, and the trivia questions and facts about the Constitution and the Federalist Papers and Articles of Federation, and et cetera, et cetera. But we've totally lost the functioning of what our republic was supposed to be between three branches of government: judicial, legislative, and of course, executive. And you know, we can talk for hours about this. I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole. But the bottom line is our executive branch has bloated in the last really 40 years, but especially the last 20 years since 9/11, to be so vastly powerful that the other two branches basically, you know, it's like, you know, Mickey Mouse ears on top of the head. I mean, the executive branch runs the show and largely runs unaccountable to the other two branches. You know, the only place laws are supposed to come from is a legislative branch. That's why they're called lawmakers. They don't make laws anymore. The laws are now administrative rulings issued by agencies within the executive branch that are then, you know, quasi-interpreted, but really they're more enforced now by the judicial branch. I mean, they use lawfare now, as we're seeing against all these cases against Trump. Lawfare is now used to enforce what the executive branch wants. And the legislative branch is basically just, you know, a useless, you know, TikTok video factory. So politicians can raise money on the side.
Yeah.
It's totally dysfunctional. And the branch of government, Article 1 of the Constitution talks about the first branch of government, the legislative branch. Now, they're co-equal, but there's a reason they put the legislature first. And that's because that's supposed to be where the rubber meets the road. That's the people's representation. And there's a reason they enumerated those powers first. And unfortunately, that's now become, you know, the third and most useless and impotent branch of government. So we have to get, but listen, you know, you said something earlier, I was inaccurate, aspiring politician, not an aspiring politician at all. I love my business. I'm a rancher. I'm a father of four young kids. I live in the middle of nowhere, Montana, for a reason. But I can't sit here and watch the country that you and I fought for, my wife fought for, her brothers fought for. You know, I still got shrapnel in my body and bullet in my body from the war. Like, I refuse to sit here and watch this insanity ruin the greatest nation in the history of mankind. And that's not jingoistic bullshit. That's just a fact. No other nation has released the power of the individual in such an amazing way as America has, created so much prosperity, protected so much freedom around the world. And you better believe it. I mean, we're at a crossroads. We really are. I mean, in New York, I mean, if you own a home and there's a goddamn squatter in there, they're going to arrest you and march you away so the squatter can stay. I mean, we're letting guys that assault criminals or assault cops in the street off on no bail, yet we're trying to arrest a former president of the United States. We've got a million people, potentially, depending on how you count the gotaways, coming across this border a month. They're getting free health care, free plane tickets, free food, free clothes. Meanwhile, we got veterans on the street homeless. We're forcing pipe fitters, welders, and truck drivers to pay off student loans for people who got a four-year degree in gender studies who can't get a job now and they bitch about their loans. I mean, it's literally insanity. Now we're saying gender is fake and boys can play girl sports. You know, after the Democrats spent, you know, 60 years fighting for gender equality, they finally got it. Now they're trying to ruin it overnight. I mean, this insanity is truly, I talked to a guy yesterday, he's like, I always voted Democrat. I was never politically active. I just did because that was the cool thing to do. That was the right thing to do because Republicans were bad. He's like, I'm voting for Trump. This stuff is crazy. And not to go on a spree here, but it just really is. And you're highlighting in a very passive way some of the insanity that we're seeing unfold in front of us. And we can't keep sending the same people back to D.C. and expecting a different result. And that's what we've been doing. 50 years in office, some of these guys.
I think lawfare is a word that people need to familiarize themselves with, because that is kind of like we went from a republic into whatever this is. Whatever it is, when Democrats say our democracy, that's what they mean is lawfare, right? So it's and we see this. There's multiple Supreme Court cases going on right now. One's already been decided about executive branch agencies turning people into felons overnight without any kind of vote in Congress, right? So let's say bump stocks and pistol braces to begin with, from the gun side. But there were a lot of things too. I mean, those are both in the Supreme Court right now, or at least heading there. But the one that's already been decided was OSHA's regulation to try to force vaccinate everybody in 2021, right? Well, that one already got shot down. Like, the Supreme Court's already ruled that it's unconstitutional for agencies to make law. But for some reason, agencies continue to do that, despite the fact that the Supreme Court, I mean, that is any lower court, that shouldn't even make it past an appellate court, frankly, right? If that that ruling already exists at the Supreme Court level, specific to federal agencies, if any federal agency criminalizes any behavior with the stroke of a pen, that should, a lower level appellate court should immediately be able to shut that down. But it's not happening, right? Because
luckily, a lot of the You're absolutely right. Mm. A lot of the state AGs, luckily, are standing up on the state level.
Texas and Mississippi, maybe, I think, Montana.
For a lot of these cases, fighting back. Waters in the United States is an important one that, you know, I don't know, where do you physically reside?
I live in Austin, Texas.
Okay, yeah. I mean, especially for Western states, you know, with a lot of public lands like Montana, Idaho, Nevada, all these places out west, there's a lot of public lands owned by the Forest Service, the BLM. And Waters of the United States, you know, is essentially hands over the Clean Water Act enforcement to, you know, the EPA and whatever federal agency, you know, can be co-opted in that area to say, hey, you know, any navigable body of water in the United States is subject to the Clean Water Act and the Waters of the United States. Any navigable body of water, and historically that meant a navigable water. You could drive a boat down it. You could navigate it with a vessel. And therefore, we wanted to ensure those navigable bodies of water stayed clear, clean, accessible, and you know, we weren't dumping toxins. We weren't, you know, building bridges across that weren't properly designed to screw up wildlife. Blah 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 blah. But this Biden administration and the Obama administration before that, they've been expanding that exactly like you said, overnight creating felons by saying, well, navigable bodies of water, but what about the tributaries and rivers and streams that feed navigable bodies of water? And they're starting to interpret the waters of the United States to say any watershed that feeds a navigable body of water is subject to the regulations herein, and we're going to apply them as such. And they're going, in one case, 14 miles up from Priest Lake to, you know, a landowner who's trying to put an irrigation ditch in, saying you can't dig that piece of your own land up, because eventually your water flows off your land will be in a navigable water, and you know, you are in violation. Basically, you're a felon now. We're going to take you to court. And to your point, massive executive overreach, and the judicial branch shouldn't have to catch up to these things years later, because the judicial system is slow. It just is, in many cases by design. And you know, you're putting these people like the cake baker in Colorado, you know, who got, you know, canceled because they didn't want to make, you know, a cake that disagreed with his religious belief. You know, it takes them years to exonerate themselves, and that ain't right. So it's a scary time. And to your point, I mean, our constitutional republic is currently at risk. And, you know, I love your sweatshirt, defund the politicians, and I tell a lot of folks that. But I also challenge you, it's so easy to hate on the politicians. And in many cases, they almost all deserve it. But we also need a new class. Mm-hmm. Like, we need a new generation of leaders to step up and save this country. And we need to recruit them, just like we did in the military. A poster, I want you. Hey, you know, I never once considered running for office until, you know, the lightning bolt hit me after Kabul fell. Like, this is a disaster. We've got to save this country. And we need to encourage people to run. It's easy to vilify the politicians, and as I said, they deserve it. But then we, on the flip side of that, we need to recruit a new generation of Americans to serve and say, listen, what's happening now is broken. You know, if you love this country like you should, if you've been to any other country, you know how lucky you are. Stand up, serve, fight. Because if we don't get regular, everyday Americans that have common sense to stand up, and in this case, instead of pick up a weapon like you and I did, pick up a pen, and go to D.C. and help save this country, we're in for a disaster.
Yeah, I want a couple of things. One, on American exceptionalism, you said that no other country in the history of human beings has released the power of the individual like we have. We also showed the efficacy of that, right? We are we're double the size of China's GDP. Roughly double, a little bit, it depends on the year, but roughly double the size, while being a fifth of their size and having contentious relationships with quite a few of our trade partners, right? It's the blueprint that shows, like, people can choose to do whatever the fuck they want. I mean, I don't think it's a good idea to tell anybody what they should and shouldn't do. As a matter of fact, I think if you do what's best for you as a country, then you'll find natural allies who actually share your values and goals, right? Which is kind of the fucking point. That seems to make sense to me. And to that other part, the right of association is fundamental to a free society. Like, if some dude doesn't want to make gay cakes, then fine. And if you're offended by that, then go start your own fucking cake business, dude. Like, you don't have the right to compel someone to do something, ever. You never have the right to compel somebody to do or say something they don't want to do, you motherfucker. I mean, that's slavery. That's why we outlawed it. And then the other part about, you know, the the executives' intrusion into the daily lives of Americans. You know what really works well? This is what I've told people for years. People have been talking about civil wars and all this stupid bullshit for years. It's like, that's dumb. What works is nullification, which is where states or local governments tell the higher level of government, no, we're not doing that. Fuck you. You know, get out of here. And it's worked twice in recent memory on two major issues, actually, which are weed and gay marriage, right? So California, Massachusetts primarily told the federal government to get fucked with regard to both of those things. Some other states with the marriage equality thing, New Hampshire and a couple of other ones, I think Vermont. But what was the result? Nothing. The federal government doesn't do anything. They only have power if you believe they have power. They only have power if you allow them to come in and have power, and they only have power if you've got your hand out when they show up, right? If you don't need anything from them, then nothing happens. And
that's what the Irish said about the British Empire when, you know, back when Ireland was trying to gain independence. They said, you know, we defeat the British Empire by ignoring it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, what the result of it was at the population level, there are still states who are holdouts and stuff, but the population level pretty much developed a libertarian attitude about both of those issues for the most part. It's like, oh, that doesn't affect me, so I don't give a shit, right? And that's the attitude you should have, frankly, right? About pretty much everything. So I wonder from your perspective, as someone who, you know, is going to be a senator in a state like Montana, what is it? Do you feel compelled to do something to shrink the size and influence of government as a part of the government, I guess? And then how would you go about that? What would be the strategy? 100%.
I mean, I think, to be honest, I think that's our greatest mandate right now. It is, we have to reduce the size of government. We have to return our government to its constitutional limitations. I mean, you and I both swore an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. And people say that, and it's an easy one sentence to say, but then read the document and read the Federalist Papers and read the construction of that document and what it really says. And what we're doing now bears no resemblance to what was crafted, you know, 250 years ago. So we have to start reducing the size. And frankly, just step one is the executive branch. We have to start cleaving parts of the executive branch off and removing authorities from the executive branch that, frankly, they don't legally have. And they've just bloated their way into it, you know, over time. The legislative branch has to return authority to itself to make laws. The sole power that can make laws, the sole body that can declare war. We're not supposed to send Americans anywhere unless Congress supports it. And why is that? Because I go back to the Powell Doctrine, because the whole point of having Congress declare war is because the House of Representatives, the people that represent people, the voters, the citizens who will have to fight the war, they will know whether the American people are behind this or not. So they're the only ones that can say, yes, America wants and is ready to go to war over this issue. And you said there's a lot of interests that want war to happen, whether there's a reason to go or not. So that power has been abdicated to the executive branch. So basically war powers, you know, the president can go to war whenever he feels like it, whether the people want it or not. So we have to return ourselves to constitutional government. I believe that would be my greatest mandate should I win. You know, we're so far beyond Republican and Democrat. I mean, I'm running as Republican. I'm a lifelong conservative. But like the labels have become meaningless. Liberal, conservative, Republican, Democrat. Like it's almost labels don't help at all anymore. We just need common sense. We need common sense. And the Constitution, when you read through that document, it really is a magical piece of paper. Mm-hmm. I mean, not to sound corny, it's just amazing the vision that those people had was incredible. And our greatest mandate has to be returning our nation to the principles of a constitutional republic.
Yeah, and if you're interested in that, about the construction of the Constitution, for the listeners out there, I would highly recommend finding a book called The Preceptor, Preceptor. It's like a middle 18th century textbook on everything from property rights to the Magna Carta and everything else, right? It's what the founders, like you, there's some direct quotes in the Constitution from the Preceptor. That's how important of a document it was. So I would check that out. And then you said, you talk about cleaving parts off of the executive. What about ending federal agencies in the way that Javier Milei has been doing in Argentina?
Is that That's what I mean. Like literally vaporize them. Like just get rid of them, collapse them. It's not going to be easy. There are thousands of employees, you know, billions of dollars of entrenched interest, but we don't have a choice. You know, we are barreling towards a fiscal disaster, many disasters, but the fiscal one is staring us in the face. But I mean, take the Department of Education, you know, stood up in 64 or 65. You know, the main reason they had at the time was to ensure desegregation, to make sure that, you know, the American education system would serve everyone, because as we know, it wasn't at the time and the decades leading up to that. But today, I mean, it does nothing other than issue indoctrination criteria and curriculum and print student loans that no one can repay. So it's like, it's literally an organization that does nothing but indebt our government further and provides no benefit to the people of America. That's not to say everyone who works there is bad. I'm not saying that at all. But I am saying as a businessman, you have to look across your business, identify profit centers, revenue centers, teams that are successful, teams that are not. I mean, the DOE, we don't need bureaucrats in D.C. telling us what to teach our kids. Like, it's pretty obvious what you need to teach them. Add, subtract, divide, you know, learn history. We don't need a curriculum to be printed in D.C. Our local teachers and educators can do that. And we need to stop these ridiculous federal student loans that have increased the cost of higher education, as you mentioned, by, in some cases, 5,000% over the last 40 years. So we start literally just cleaving agencies. Sometimes their work share can be folded in another agency. Sometimes their work share doesn't need to exist at all. So just get rid of them. So absolutely. We need to, and we've reorganized our government before. That's happened before. You know, we've had government reorganization acts mandated by Congress, which we should have again. We should have a, you know, 2025 reorganization of the American Government Act that goes through and literally restructures our government for the 21st century. If you were a business and you never reorganized yourself for 50 years, which is basically where we're at as a government, you'd be in trouble.
Right.
We're operating 1950 styles bureaucracy. We better modernize ourselves for the 21st century.
Yeah, we have. And to the other point you made, we have this tendency to build a weapon or a tool to fix a specific problem, and then we never put it away once the job is done. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, it's
income tax is supposed to be temporary.
Yeah. I mean, it's like you can't. This is why people like I sympathize with the people who just shout out infringe when it comes to guns all the time, because it is. And some people will say that the slippery slope argument is facile. I'm like, if anything, the gun debate shows that it's not, because it's been a slow creep for decades to try to hamstring individuals' right to defend themselves. It seems like a decent way to handle something like that would just be a mandatory sunset clause in every bill, right? I mean,
yes.
Like why? And we've reorganized our government. Let's see, the New Deal, I guess, would be a big one. The way that it wasn't necessarily on paper. But the military-industrial complex in the 1950s reorganized our government to some degree as well, and then the Patriot Act and DHS.
Well, it wasn't what you just said was the National Defense Act of 1947, National Security Act.
Yeah, National Security Act. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, and that literally reformed our entire government around the Cold War. Around everything became focused on national security.
And then again, they didn't say it out loud, but the DHS and the Patriot Act changed things. Again, right? We completely reorganized our government. I think those two things specifically, I mean, they gave unprecedented power to the intelligence community, which is executive agencies without any oversight. I mean, this FISA stuff is a joke. It's very bizarre to me that I don't know. I mean, I think it's maybe I blame us. I blame the people for the most part. Like these politicians that go to D.C. that are, you know, hungry little pieces of shit for power and money, right? Like that's who they are as people. We should expect that behavior from them. It's us that fell asleep at the wheel. It's us that gave them the keys to the car because we didn't want to drive down to the gas station to fill it up, right? That was our fault for doing that stuff. But the good news is, if it's a matter of effort and attention, then we can correct that pretty easily, right? It's just a matter of paying attention and putting forth some fucking effort. You know what I mean? It's again, two very different examples. I've been talking about this a lot lately, of even uncoordinated civil action. So COVID shutdowns, forced vaccination shit, all that stuff went down. And a lot of people went along to get along because they didn't want to lose their jobs or they didn't want to be outed socially or whatever the fuck else. And it was the government ran roughshod over the entire country. And then there was another a very different outcome with the government's disinformation board, where they wanted to codify censorship of American citizens, right? That's led specifically by the federal government, by DHS. And pretty much everybody on every side of the political spectrum were like, no, we're not doing that. And that shit went away in about 2.5 months, right? So it's like, what can I do? People always ask, what can I do? Saying no and encouraging other people to say no, as Andrew Jackson said, one man with courage makes a majority, right? Saying no to intrusion into your life has way more of a powerful effect than you think it does. It has more of an effect than going to protest somewhere or boycotting something. Just saying no together really loud sometimes is like, that's enough.
Yeah, the power of no is incredible. I've got to get going to a veterans event here. I got to hop in the truck and drive, but I want to thank you for having me on. It's been great chatting, and we should come back again, you know, throughout the campaign. You know, this is a very important race. It just is. It's not because I want to be a senator. Promise you, there's much better things I'd rather do with my time. But like you joined up, like I joined up during the war, you know, our nation's in peril, and now it's calling for people to fight in a different way. And we need to get common sense Americans. As you said, we've been asleep at the wheel. We handed our keys to a bunch of lobbyists, lawyers, and bureaucrats, and now we don't like where they drove us. Well, they're going to keep driving the car until we take it back. So we need to get in there, and the constitutional republic depends on engaged citizenry. And right now we don't have an engaged citizenry. Our citizens are busy watching YouTube, watching TikTok, taking selfies. They are not paying attention to the nation, which has given them so much prosperity and freedom. And that's why I'm doing this. So I'd love to come back again during the race and talk about what we're doing, because this race will determine control of the U.S. Senate. As cynical as you and I are both on politics, you know, the Democrat Party has been very clearly what they intend to do with the Senate majority. They want to eliminate the filibuster, add two more states, D.C. and Puerto Rico, and expand the Supreme Court. That would spell a structural end to constitutional principles for about a generation. And we've got to stop that before it happens. And this race will determine control of the Senate with a, you know, 25-year, you know, multi-term incumbent opponent here who is a loyal foot soldier for those policies. We got to send him home, or we got to bring some common sense back to D.C. So timfremt.com is where people can learn more. I want to thank you for your time and your service as well. And this is an important race. You know, we all want to defund politicians. Trust me, I'm the largest donor to my campaign. I don't get any money out of this, but we got to save this country.
100%. Thanks for coming today. I really appreciate it. Everybody go check him out. Tim Shee, appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. And thank you all for listening. This has been Citizen.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
Probably the easiest thing I've ever done. The medication comes in the mail and it's very easy to use. I've been able to live my normal lifestyle and I've lost 20 pounds already and I've never felt better. It changed my life.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.